On this week's episode of That Sound Podcast, we have the multi-instrumentalist Evan Walsh. Evan is formerly the drummer in The Stripes.
He has now got his new project, The Savage Hearts, who has dropped a single this week, Gang War. Here is our conversation with Evan. We hope you enjoy it.
On this week's episode of That Sound Podcast, we have the multi-instrumentalist Evan Walsh. Bass player, drummer, pianist, saxist. From David Letterman to Conan O'Brien to Glastonbury to touring all around the world. He's seen it, he's done it, he's wore the t-shirt, and now he's sitting here with us.
Yes.
Evan, a pleasure to have you on the podcast, man.
Cheers, lads. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming on this wonderful evening.
Yeah, beautiful night, isn't it? Yeah,
good,
summer night.
Good calving weather.
Yeah.
So you've been busy.
Yeah, very busy at the minute. Savage Hearts, the new band project, kind of. We got our first single out on the 26th of February, last Saturday, which would have been the 9th of March. We did our launch party kind of gig at a secret undisclosed location, which is now fully disclosed to most people. Couldn't be happier, to be honest, with the buzz of the track, you know, people
Gang
sharing
Wars,
it and covering it.
It's a dingo, man.
Thanks.
Speed Kills.
Yeah.
And Gavin were talking about Speed Kills is definitely one of our favourites.
Oh, that's great. It's a bit of a Ramones homage, like Ramones meets a bit of 50s with a bit of this.
Definitely.
Kind of like with them B-sides. I'm very keen on singles having B-sides and stuff, even on Spotify and things like that. And you kind of want the B-side, you want to let loose a wee bit.
And you did let loose on that one. It's just a party going on in your head.
It's a bit more of a laugh, you know, that kind of thing.
It's a brilliant tune, though.
Thanks very much.
It's absolutely class.
Thanks.
I was actually talking to Dave Moore the other day, who was listening to it from Today FM.
Oh, are you joking? That's funny. It's finding out live on air.
He was a fan.
All right, must get his email off.
Reach out to him on Instagram.
Absolutely, because we're on a wee label with this great little label, Blowtorch Records,
over in Galway.
Over in Galway, and they're a great crowd. Richard, is the main man. It's like fully independent operation and all that, so it's kind of like, it's nice after in the Stripes days, you know, there was a lot of you know, we were very happy initially, but then I think the more you kind of go through that side of the business, the more things get taken out of your hands, and then you have to try and claw them back.
You had more freedom now with Blowtorch.
Complete freedom. So I always had a feeling I would, and I did in theory, but actually working with an indie label, I way prefer that freewheeling spirit, you know what I mean? You're doing your thing and you're presenting it to somebody who wants to, you know, help you get it out there, as opposed to when you're on the major label thing, they kind of want to, well, you know, you're an investment to them. So it's kind of like, or it's like a...
Yeah, you do what I say.
Well, yeah, it's kind of like, yeah, kind of like... Yeah.
Afraid ends of sanity. You can do it your own way if it's done just
And it's kind of like, you can do it your way, but it'll be a little bit harder. Because you know, they won't maybe throw their weight behind it if they don't think it's what you should be doing, you know, that sort of thing. But more on that
as we go. So let's go back to the start then. You went to school in Cavan?
Cavan, just outside Cavan town. And I actually was with two of the lads out of the Stripes, three of us were in the same primary school.
Okay.
So we were always in that kind of musical environment, you know, from a very early age, kind of crack.
And what kind of stuff were you listening to in the early days?
Oh, well, I'm from a family of absolutely hardcore, like devastating Beatle fanatics, as in like just major.
Right, okay.
On both sides of the family, you know, huge music fans, on like, as in a lot of my uncles and even aunties and thing, cousins and all that, with loads of musicians in the family. And there was a hardcore kind of Beatles thing, which kind of informed my whole view of bands, view of everything like that, you know, would have grown up. Like, me and my sister, she's very musical as well, and when we were really small, like, we'd be watching like Hard Day's Night, all the Beatle movies, and the Monkees, Hey Were the Monkees TV show, all that kind of thing. So all them videos, all the VHSs were on repeat, like, when we were kids. So, what you call it, that idea of a band is like a kind of a fun, wacky, cool thing to do. Yeah. Was kind of like embedded in us from that age, from seeing the Beatles films and seeing all that stuff.
And was the boys similar? The boys in...
The lads probably would have come from different backgrounds in the sense that they'd all had musicians in their families, probably just coming at it from different angles. And I think it was really when they started coming over, you know, my house was kind of the epicentre of it. I've noticed that.
That was the hub.
I'm a madman for reading into bands. I'm always reading biographies and, you know, researching. I love kind of music history is nearly a huge part of me. Interest in music. It's kind of like what fascinates me. So like there's always seems to be an epicentre for bands. They always seem to go to somebody's house.
Yes.
Or somebody's, you know, garage or whatever. There's a chosen location. And so our house was the
hub.
The place where the hub is right. And bit like this is the hub here.
This is the hub.
Maybe you being a drummer dictated that.
Would have had a lot to do with it as well. Yeah. There would have been a bit of rehearsing in one of the other boys' garage, but it was never as you know. There was always time wasted bringing gear and, you know, backing the car up with the drum kit in it and all that sort of stuff. So
most tedious job known to man.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's why I gave myself a break. Jumped on the bass for a minute, just to change it up for a minute. And we both know that pain, you know.
Oh man. Well, unfortunately I don't know it just yet, or the luxury of having a tech, but I'm sure fabulous one.
When you can have one, it's great. We had a great I'll shout out actually John Mack.
Brilliant.
was the guy who was with the Stripes for all them years, and he actually, totally weird coincidence, kind of like he came through another end of the industry, came to work with us, but turned out he played in the 80s with a band, my dad's band had played with. So felt like we'd known him our whole lives And so
that's incredible.
Shout out to John, he was an absolute legend. He was our sound man and my drum tech in one go for most of the Stripes time.
Brilliant.
Great lad.
Well,
shout out John.
Yeah.
Keep rocking.
And he is, I know for a fact he is. He's a drummer and does his own thing. Tours with loads of bands and all that, so
brilliant.
So
after we say jamming in your house with the boys and your first gig, where did you go? Did you play at school or
so I wouldn't have been, the funny thing is it probably wasn't very publicly musical, if you know what I mean. At school age it wasn't like, you know, there wasn't the outlet really, I don't think. Just the way the thing fell, but the kind of the revelation for ourselves and for everybody else really was we had put, when we were kids, we played a school concert one year, and we actually were called the Stripes back then,
like
12, and we just came, that's where we came up with the name. We had to do like 3 songs at the school concert, and that's where the name came out of around that time. So like the lads would have been going over to my house, and we would have been kind of getting immersed in the things that, you know, me and my sister growing up immersed in. So we were kind of getting a wee act together of a few songs that we
just doing covers at that.
Doing covers, and kind of, you know, random covers at that. You know what I mean? You haven't got the concept of direction in your head yet at that age. You know, like it's like, you know, 11, 12, 13, that kind of age. You know, so you're only really getting the idea in your head of, well, we'll do a Beatles song and we'll do Teenage Kicks and we'll do all the classics.
I think everybody does.
Yeah. Everybody does Teenage Kicks and
everything's fresh and Twist and Shout is such a good go-to as well.
All them songs that you start playing, you know, we would have done like that. Like I Feel Fine would have been the Beatles one done. And
Hey Jude, would that have been another one?
No, actually, I didn't play Hey Jude. I think that would have been a bit too complicated at that age with the piano and all that, but... I've played Hey Jude since then in other situations, but what was I going to say? Yeah, we would have done like kind of a bit of a shadow of what was going to come. We like did a few Chuck Berry rock and roll music Chuck Berry, and
nice.
And
that Johnny was, be good.
Yeah. And that would have been, I would have been pushing that from an early age. I think, like, again, since I was about 9 or 10, I think I got mad into the Chuck Berry CD that we had in the house, and that kind of became very formative for what has come since, has all been kind of hovering around.
For sure,
that,
and
you know?
I think that's evident in your style from especially Snapchat on some of those. Heavier, fast, or more driven songs.
Definitely.
The speed was incredible.
Yeah.
I remember going to see you guys play as the Stripes in the Olympia. In the day. Opened with Rebel Rebel.
Oh, yeah, David Bowie just died.
Absolutely incredible. For myself, it was such an inspiration, actually,
right.
To try and push the boat.
Yeah,
that's where I aspired to be, was to be up on that stage to see you play with some of that intensity. And just the speed of the right hand. But even the shuffle
at that
speed was like, oh, man.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and like some people have that experience, Evan, of, you know, they go to a gig and they see something, they're like, oh, man, I want to stop playing or throw this out the window. It's like, I just wanted to get home.
Oh,
I remember
weird.
The boys in the band.
I want to get out of here.
Yeah, I was playing in Black Tie Event at the time.
And
we all went as a band.
Yeah.
And we went for a couple of drinks after it and then went home. And I remember just thinking in the pub, was like being so consumed by the gig. It's like, I just want to go home and practice.
Oh, well, geez, means a lot.
Where's my practice pad? Where's I need to level up here.
Cheers.
So that was a fabulous gig experience.
Thanks very much. I like them Olympia gigs. Excuse me. We did, I think, the Olympia 3 times, I think, or something, over the course of a few years.
Nice.
And we played at other times, did like charity gigs, charity bills in there. I always thought it was great.
Yeah.
Playing the old theatre style.
Yeah, there's a lot of character to that place.
Yeah, I love that kind of crack when you get
and
onto that.
And there's so many big names have played that venue.
Absolutely.
Johnny Cash and
Bruno Mars was another one who would have played that.
Like, when you're walking out, you see the pictures on the wall.
Your
guys are probably there, I'm sure, too.
Well, I don't know if we reached that stage yet.
It's definitely an iconic
Absolutely. Venue. It's a fabulous place to play.
One of the plenty that you did play in, but we'll get there.
But thanks very much for that. All those nice words about that.
No, that was a great memory, especially from early on.
I
was only maybe 17 at the time, so
that's the
direction I wanted to head. Very much so, I had my heart set on that, and I was like,
this is
incredible.
Oh, that's great. You say about the right hand was my own worst enemy, I think, for most of me drumming time, because I kind of aspired, like you're saying, like, to get that really fast tempo. Like, we can get on to influences and all that, but like, a lot of drummers that I would have been listening to would have had that really fast
right hand.
And shuffling and things like that, coming from the kind of blues place.
Like, that shuffling Blue Collar Jane is just
That's kind of a blues thing mixed with a kind of a, I suppose, kind of a 60s 70s
we'll get back to the tech stuff later, but if I can remember rightly, I think, was it like a Red Oyster Pearl Ludwig kit you would have played time?
Yes, you're dead right.
Yeah,
you're dead right.
I remember being infatuated.
Man, it was
class too. The finish on that was like...
Cheers.
I was just blown away by the whole thing.
Yeah. I know, I like that now. I had a couple of kits. Still actually have them, a few kits in that finish, you know.
Nice.
From back then.
From back then.
The early endorsement days, you know. Yeah.
That's the good people over at Ludwig.
Yeah. All the lovely sound legends over in the Ludwig Corporation. Yeah.
Awesome. Cool.
So
you were 16 when you got signed, is that right?
That's right, yeah. I just turned 16. Ross the singer was 15. That was the big story.
How did that happen?
At the time. In a kind of a funny series of events, because we put out our own EP, we were at this stage in the hardcore kind of rhythm and blues background. We wanted that kind of, Dr. Feelgood was the band that really hit us like a ton of bricks, which is to say, it's kind of developing on from that Chuck Berry thing, listening to the old Chuck Berry compilation CDs and things like that. Then we came across bands like, there's a kind of a whole late 70s sort of scene called pub rock, which would be like a lot of them real back to basics bands, kind of mostly in England, a lot of real English back to basics, like proto punk bands, really, that before the Sex Pistols and before the Clash, the kind of bands that those lads would have gone to see in those kind of small clubs in London and all that. So, like, Dr. Feelgood would have been a key. They were kind of like, they were like an English version of like those bands like the MC5 and all that kind of were punk before punk, but Dr. Feelgood were specifically coming from a kind of an R&B background, but doing it in this kind of proto punk kind of way. And Eddie and the Hot Rods and, Rockpile, another band, Dave Edmonds and Nick Lowe. And we kind of got into this little obscure little scene, and we were like, that's the thing we want to do. And the early Who as well, and the Animals and bands like that, you know, would have been the kind of key references. So we had a kind of an EP that we put together of just 4 covers from the set, and we were going back and kind of getting a lot of old blues songs and giving them the treatment that we thought those bands...
Okay, you put a twist on it, yeah?
Yeah, the bands we were being influenced by, we were putting that spin on it, the Yardbirds, like, you know, bands like that. We would have been kind of totally in consumed by that kind of buzz, you know. And
what a great era of music.
Yeah. So it kind of like, and taking a bit from all them kind of 50s, kind of between the 50s and the 80s, a lot of different influences from around those different times we were kind of taken from. And YouTube was a big thing in that as well, because we were one of the first people that said this about us at the time. We were one of the first generations, like as in of people in bands, to grow up with YouTube as your source of inspiration, you know, because it kind of stops you from thinking, oh, well, this is current and that's not, and that's this, not. You don't know, you're not thinking about it. You're just thinking, well, I'm looking at, you know, like, let's say a modern band I really like, let's say the OCs, American kind of garage surf band. You'd be watching them 1 minute, then you're watching the Kinks the next minute, then you're watching something else. You know, so you're a bit like, well, it's all just there. It's just like a big library, basically. It'd be like
encyclopedia.
Yeah, it'd be like going to the library and not reading a book from, you know, 100 years ago, you know, and only reading what came out this year. You know, it's kind of like, you know. So we had this EP, and through some kind of buzz, really, our own kind of, you know, persistence, really, we were kind of sending it away to all sorts of people, and we made a video. It was directed by a friend of ours, Finn Keenan, who has gone on to do really great things in filmmaking, video making and all that. But like, it got played, I think through that, I think it got played on RTE, a pre-scandal Tuberty. Pre-pay scandal Tuberty. Played it on his show, and then that led to us actually being asked on The Late Late.
The Toy Show, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, we actually did The Toy Show before that, even when we were young. Yeah, we actually got on The Toy Show.
That was
before the EP. Okay. So that's actually another little pocket of history as well, that we ended up, we got on The Toy Show around the time, only in the years following us doing the school concert kind of crack. We got onto that.
And you played a couple of times, was it?
It would have gone a couple of years. And it was just a thing that you do, you know, the way, like, when you're that age, everybody wants to be on the Toy Show and so on.
And get noticed and get yourself out there.
And I even know loads of people in Cavan who, like, had also applied to be on the Toy Show. Kind of, in subsequent years, met people that were like, oh, you applied to do that as well. So, like, we got on, that was 2010, so we were still very young. And then, only a couple of years later, we actually got on the proper Late Late, doing one of the tracks from the EP, and through that, record label people in Ireland saw us. Then, you know, the way in the music industry, so like the buzz, it's a very small place, really. It's like a small little village where everybody knows each other. Yeah. You know, the buzz was passed from the record labels in Dublin, you know, told the people in England about us. We were going over and we started playing in London, getting a few gigs and all that. So kind of just on our own kind of natural buzz, really, that we just gigged and gigged and gigged. And it was only us and me dad, really.
Dad was a big force, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he was the big, you know, like my parents were a big influence on me musically and all that, because they're such music heads, you know, sort of thing. So we kind of grew up with a kind of a mutual respect of our tastes, me and my sister and my parents and all that. So, my dad had been in bands. He was the only one, really, of all our parents who'd actually been in a proper band and done, you know, like, you know, gigged around the place, and he'd been to gigs in England and been on telly, you know, and stuff like that, and done a few bits, like put out a few singles and things like that. So we were rehearsing up in the bedroom, and then when we wanted to get gigging, it was him that we asked,
right,
to, can you bring us here, can you bring us there?
Okay.
And so he would be totally reluctant, nearly, to take any credit, wrongly in my view, but anyway,
it was him that opened some doors, though.
It
dad
was like,
became the driving force and the roadie.
Exactly, he became the literal driving force, because he was the only, he was bringing us around the place, because we were so young, and we got, like, you know, offered, like, we were just putting up YouTube videos and things like that, and somebody who ran a club night in Dublin offered us a thing, and it was, I think we kind of had this thing that we looked very different and we sounded very different.
Yes.
And we had a bit of this prodigious vibe about
us. Yeah, definitely.
So people were drawn to that and saying, oh, will you come and play this here? And so that's kind of where it kind of just, I think some people thought that when we kind of got up to a higher level with the band, people thought it was because of our age and all that, people thought it was kind of a careerist thing, and it couldn't have been less of that. Like, none of us had had designs in a career, as in, we all thought, wouldn't it be great if in years and years time that happened? We weren't thinking it was going to happen tomorrow, you know. It was kind of like other people came to us and projected their image of ourselves onto us. You know what I mean? As in people thought we were what they wanted us to be, in the sense that people thought, oh, well, it makes sense. It's this story where, you know, it was all kind of supposed to happen, and it really wasn't.
It was really a unique selling point, whereas you guys were just being yourselves. And
we were literally just being ourselves. And we were just being little nerdy lads as well, as in we were totally obsessive over the bands we were into. There was no kind of like, it wasn't like, we weren't very hip, like, you know what I mean? We were just off in our own little corner, obsessing over these obscure bands, you know, trying to, you know, dig deeper and deeper into these kind of... And the attraction, definitely for me, the attraction was, like, you know, the finding the slightly off-the-beaten-track music. And you know, I mean, like, Chuck Berry's hardly off-the-beaten-track, but, you know, like...
I know what you mean,
in
though.
In a relative context. You know, like, we kind of... That led us into more kind of blues-based... Bo Diddley, John Lee Hooker, all that stuff, which still really resonates with me today. You know what I mean? It hasn't, my taste hasn't changed that much really in all that time. You know, it's just kind of maybe got a bit more diverse or something. But so it kind of just happened without us wanting it or intending it to.
Doors just kept opening.
You know what I mean? And I think maybe people might have perceived it as, well, this was obviously a, you know, a concerted effort to create this buzz, create this thing with this kind of weird novelty angle to it.
Yeah.
And that never, we were as clueless as the next fella, you know, when it came to that kind of thing. So people just, as I say, projected onto us of, you will be this band that's going to do well at this young age and we're going to bring you here and bring you there and all that. And we were going, I mean, why not? If it's going to happen, if it's going to happen now, then... It might as well, you know, sort of thing.
You rode the wave, you just went with it. And...
Well, exactly, And I mean, it was that kind of thing of, if you don't do it now, maybe it's not going to happen ever. And then if you do it at the time that, the kind of, you're aligned with what's going on for whatever reason, it's like, you know, this kind of, you know, this direction, we're being brought in this direction organically by life. So if we kind of took the risk and we rolled with it, in the sense that we all... quit school, and my dad had to leave his job because they wouldn't let him keep his job and be working with us. So there was a lot of sacrifices like that that you're kind of thinking, well, but what if this doesn't pan out? Do you know what I mean? We're all kind of slightly fucked. You know what I mean? So there was a lot on the line, which is why we kind of went for the major label thing, because we were kind of being headhunted by... There was a period, people told us since then, that there was a period where we were the most sought after... talked about band in London on the music scene, as in the record label scene in London, which didn't feel like that at the time, but like Universal, Sony, RCA, Rough Trade, everybody was having meetings with us. We were kind of we were in talks with, you know, and I think we were, even back then, and this is where it's kind of like, I suppose it's a sliding doors moment or something like that, like we were drawn to the indie thing back then. We were thinking, oh, Rough Trade, oh, whatever. But being really just coldly practical about things, we'd made such a sacrifice with our lives, basically, and people's families had made a lot of sacrifices to let us do this, to make this thing happen. And there was a lot riding on it. So it was kind of like, at that time, there was an element of, well, something that's going to be stable, and the major label at that time offered us a more stable... income, more stable things,
contract,
longer terms, longer, more money into recording and into touring and things like that, which, you know, it's not very cool, but you have to kind of take that into consideration. I mean, there's all that stuff.
When you get that back, and you got to take it with both hands and just sort of run with it.
Kind of, because you could have, the rock and roll cred and say, nah, we kind of, we went the hardcore way. But we would have liked to have done that at that time, but... It just, you think about it, if you said to most 16-year-olds, you know, to be making these decisions and
did you feel a lot of pressure, like, because of the sacrifices that people made, or were you still riding that wave?
A little bit, yeah. I think as it went on, there's an element of sacrifice to it, because we were sacrificing...
Like you say about your dad and all that. When that decision was coming, were you still just going, Was the pressure there to make the right decision for everybody?
Well, there was always, in those early years, there was a little undercurrent of, oh God, are we really actually making this decision? You know, that kind of thing.
Are we doing this?
Yeah.
Is this happening?
Yeah, and it's like, exactly. And it's like, even if you're, I don't know if you know that, maybe you find that yourself in a situation where you're making something happen or something's happening that you wanted to happen, but you've nearly thought about it so much you've overthought it and you don't know whether you really want it to happen when it comes to it. You know that kind of feeling? There's a bit kind of a...
Yeah, it's just right before you jump in.
Yeah, you're a bit like, oh God, am I really...
Am I doing this?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like,
maybe this isn't everything I thought it was going to be.
But then it's
back to that saying of you got to jump in to swim.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Because I remember even when we were doing the signing of the record deal and all that sort of stuff and it was kind of like... You're moving in slow motion. You're literally, in a way, you're like signing the deal, and as you're doing it, you're like, what if this goes tits up? And then you're signing like that. And we were particularly cynical 16-year-olds, maybe because.
We were so young, like.
Yeah, well, we spent all our time really watching. Music documentaries and reading books and all that about people getting fucked over by
which is a big thing, managers and record labels, and unusually, so the story goes, and
unusually enough for young lads, we were hyper aware of that because it was like we knew all the cliches
from your dad, I suppose.
And
which is fabulous that you had that influence.
You had someone with
a head of sense, because maybe not to put words in your mouth or say how you were feeling all of you were. It was probably a benefit at 16 that you loved what you'd done and you're like, this is the coolest thing ever. Like, why wouldn't we do this? And maybe didn't overthink it to an extent.
Totally. We definitely had, we had enough awareness to think, to have a slight kind of, we want to do this, but in your back of your mind, you're going, God, imagine if this all went totally tits up and it was really, you know, or...
Back to school.
Or if...
Billy Madison. Back to school. Back to school.
Exactly. Or you could do that, or you could end up thinking, even back then there was some sort of vague notion of like, what if you get compromised from what you really want to be doing or all that sort of stuff. But,
did you feel that from the very start?
Well, we always worried about it. Okay. We always really worried about it because from day one, because what we were doing was a really, at that time, very unusual thing. Where I even think now, like, let's say, with the Savage Hearts, like the current band and all that, we're coming from like a garage rock, bit of psych in there,
kind of influence,
all that kind of thing. You know, it's kind of coming from that more fuzzy, heavier garage rock place, which we were kind of unconsciously driving towards even back in the early Stripes days, which we didn't maybe have the terminology for it, but I even think nowadays that sort of stuff is a little bit more in vogue with certain bands and with certain scenes.
Yeah.
Certain scenes are healthier now than even in 2012 when we signed the deal.
Yeah.
We weren't really, we didn't have many reference points because we were 16. We weren't like, totally familiar with like, you know, West Coast Underground garage rock labels. So we weren't going to be like, that's where it belongs.
Let's fly to California and let's seek out this producer or this manager.
We knew what we wanted to do, but then when you kind of end up meeting with labels, even from day one, there's talk of, we could get so-and-so to write the songs and we get so-and-so to do this and we get so-and-so to do that. And it was kind of like the line that we always said, it's like, we love everything about you, how can we change it? We love everything about you is the line, because obviously, particularly when we got to London and we were like the so-called hip, sought-after buzz band, we were actually totally cynical even back then in that regard, that people were like, you know, I remember because we were 16 and all that, people thought they could impress us by kind of whipping out,
a lot of smoke and mirrors, a lot of name dropping,
a lot of kind of PowerPoint presentations of music needs new legends and heroes and all that. And we were a bit like,
you obviously had a good team around you. It sounds like your dad really was he was over the shoulder going, no lads,
and I think we had a no bullshit. And I think part of the thing as well was that we were already being influenced by bands, maybe like, you know, to say Dr. Feelgood and all those bands, their whole ethos was kind of no bullshit. It was very much an anti-bullshit, anti-trendy thing. So we were really like in that kind of...
It was the punk thing.
Rage Against the Machine.
And so we were kind of in that anti-trendy, anti-whatever headspace. So like, you know, I remember we went to a label meeting and, you know, people were saying, you know, it's nearly like that, you know, they're talking about how everybody's having a great laugh. And it's like, tell you what, it's always like this, isn't it? It's always like this in here. And so-and-so came in and, you know, one of the bands, whoever they had signed at that time, you know, he just came in and he just like stood on the table and started jamming with his guitar. And it was like awesome. And we were like, that's so lame. That sounds so naff. And it's also totally a lie. you know what I mean? Like, how is that, you know?
But I'm sure there's plenty of gays 16, 17 that would have swallowed that all up.
Yeah, I think so. And probably because I think we just had that grounding in the whole world of bands. It was like, that was the world that we came
from. You were learning from 12, 13.
Yeah. And even before that, like, I mean, even like, when I was a kid, I remember like it's like the Beatles thing growing up with the massive Beatles influence, the Beatles anthology documentaries, you know, the 8-part.
Yeah.
We would have them on video. And sure, when I was like 6 and 7, I was just wandering over and putting the anthology in and George Harrison talking about his first acid experience and all that sort of stuff. And it was just obviously unconsciously.
Daddy, what's acid?
Yeah.
Just a little bit closer.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, that was just kind of all that stuff was thinking in about and all the, you know, like how these band stories go, you know what I mean? About, you know, oh, well, you know, different labels, you know, people getting rejected by labels
and
management coming in and messing things up and people getting swindling money and all that was all kind of just part of it. And then by the time, as I say, we got to that sort of signing age, like, we were very, very anti, like, at that time, we were, because I think it was because we were young and all that, everybody was throwing around words like X Factor and throwing all that, you know, which it's like, you know, that was very much of that era. And we were totally...
That wasn't us.
But when we started getting into that area of labels and things like that, so I think that's why we never swallowed it, that we were always like, you know, we knew what we liked, we knew where we were coming from. We were very anti-showbiz, very anti... More in our attitude. We were much more like, you know...
We wanted to be commercial. You wanted to be yourselves.
Not at all. And, I mean, there was later some kind of very, I think, wrong-footed attempts to get the Stripes to be commercial, which I think the band suffered, to be honest. The more of a pressure there was on us to do something that might have been a little bit more commercial or less, you know, what we were really about. I just think the band suffered really and it never suited us, you know what I mean?
Okay. So then in 2012? No, what year was Snapshot?
2013.
Yeah, yeah. September 2013 actually. Yeah,
and it reached number 2 in the Irish charts.
It did. We were
number 5 in England?
Yeah, number 5 in England. We were pipped to the post in Ireland by Arctic Monkeys. The label, they wanted us to be out at the same time as Arctic Monkeys because, you know, we were going on tour with them.
Was that the era of AM?
It was AM, was number 1. When we were number 2 in Ireland. So that was not a bad start. Yeah, because it was AM fairly dominated that whole era. You know, that was a great album too. Yeah.
And that was produced by Chris Thomas, is that right? Mm. Yeah. He worked with Elton John, Pink Floyd, Beatles.
Sex Pistols, Roxy Music, Chris Thomas. Funny enough, I don't know, again, I'm going back to the Beatle obsessive thing. The Disney Plus Beatles thing. Oh, sorry.
Pull it there in a wee, just a wee touch, I think, yeah?
Right, yeah, good luck. Just maybe take it in a wee bit more if that's cool.
I can do that.
Just so we get it.
No bother.
Thank you.
The Disney Plus Get Back Beatles thing.
Oh, yeah.
Chris Thomas is in that.
Oh,
which
no
is really
way.
Weird. He's one of the young engineers in that. So if he's ever sticking that on Disney Plus, I've probably watched it about 37 times now, all 9 hours of it. But there's a bit, I think in the third episode, the engineers in the Apple studio are kind of doing their bits and pieces and their names come up beside them all. And we were like going, I'm pretty sure that's fucking Chris Thomas. And thinking, geez, it really looks like a young Chris Thomas. And then about 10 minutes later, the credit comes up in the corner of the screen, Chris Thomas, assistant engineer. So he would have worked on the White Album and those Get Back sessions as well. So that was mental. And then he produced Nevermind the Bollocks, Sex Pistols album.
Oh, shit.
He fully produced that one. Wow. Yeah. And produced Ian Jury. I'd be a big fan of Ian Jury. He would have produced his first band. And I engineered Dark Side of the Moon and things like that.
So that was just a wealth of knowledge to have.
Crazy, absolutely crazy. Fingertips. Yeah. And he kind of came out of retirement, really, to to produce us. He hadn't produced anybody in ages.
Wow.
And swiftly he went back into retirement when he had to deal with major record labels again. I think he remembered why he retired, you know, that kind of thing.
I'm sure that was tough.
Mm.
Whereabouts did you record that album?
So, Evan, we recorded that album. We were in a funny situation with that because we had found this studio down in Sussex, so just kind of near Brighton, but out in the countryside, and we were staying in this house that was near there. We were put there to make some demos in the first stages of signing and things like that. And we really liked the studio. We were really comfortable in it. We'd obviously, it was weird, we'd never recorded in England before. I don't think we'd ever recorded professionally before. It had always been like our friends, you know, a friend of my dad's or so-and-so relation, knew somebody who had a home studio. You know, I was always just done in somebody's house, you know, doing the first EPs and that. And so, we were in a professional studio for the first time, and it was quite a small-scale studio, really, as in it wouldn't have been up to the standard of, like, a Chris Thomas. You know, he'd been, you know, he'd be used to being in all the, you know, the most high-powered...
The top-end...
Top end studios. Yeah, he's kind of, Chris Thomas is like booking Abbey Road day one. It'd be the level he'd normally operate at. But we liked this studio, and maybe, I don't know whether it was just familiarity on our part or well, the label are always happy to save money. That never any time it's like, oh, you want to use that really cheap as fuck studio? Surely. Oh,
let's do that.
Yeah. That sounds like a plan to me.
Well, it worked.
Cheers.
It damn
and is
worked.
That where you recorded Snapchat then?
Yeah. So we did it there and
Snapchat.
So it was, it was, I suppose, for Chris Thomas, it was a several steps down, you know, like down the ladder, but. We had a great time with him, though. We had a really good time working with him. And
it's a great album.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Thanks very much.
What an album.
Thanks very much. I think I'm pretty happy with it overall. You know, that it's like, I think it kind of captured exactly what we were like at that time.
Is that your favourite album?
Probably is, yeah. Of the three we did, it probably is, because I suppose enough time has passed now, I really don't like the second one.
That's interesting.
Yeah. I really don't like the second one, and I quite like the third one. I think the third one was closer to where we were going.
Mm.
But it was probably fell between two stools a wee bit.
That was in Dean Street Studios, wasn't it?
The second album was done in Dean Street, yeah. That was the label.
It topped the charts label pressure in Ireland.
It did actually, yeah. So it was, I think, on the back of we'd done lots of things like the Arctic Monkeys tour was a big one for us.
Yeah.
So like around
what
the time,
was that like?
So yeah. So that was fantastic. That was really brilliant. So like, I mean, the release of our first album it wasn't really a coincidence that you go into a record shop and there's AM. Oh, and on the other rack beside it is the band that's supporting them on the upcoming tour.
Yeah.
And I can't remember how we were asked to do that, but we were offered. We were just asked to do it. Our agent just told us the offer had come through. I think because the buzz was just kind of gradually, as I say, you know, even though, let's say, the label might contrive to put the album out, say, oh, we'll put it out soon, we've got the Monkeys, and that's their job to be doing marketing and all that. But I mean, the actual following, because we were kind of at loggerheads with the label, even from the early days, we were always not doing what we were told and not doing what they ideally wanted us to do, meant that the success that we had and the buzz that was happening was much more just down to us touring and gigging. And we got the odd telly slot and things like that in England. But we did, like, Jules Holland was a big one.
Yeah.
But we weren't on telly in England really that much. You know, maybe, I think, just that one time. Mm. But, you know, we never really kind of saw eye to eye with them, the UK label in particular. So it was, like, you know, much less contrived than it would have been if we had have even gone along with them. We probably could have had a bigger buzz. Mm. But the way things were, we were always pushing against, you know, it was like a kind of a tug of war situation most of the time. So that kind of buzz, it was all kind of snowballing, and probably like a high point definitely being the Arctic Monkeys tour.
Was that a European tour? Was that
UK and Europe. Yeah. So we were probably about 2 months with them, I'd say.
That was big arenas. Like.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. Like Earl's Court, played Earl's Court, which you don't have anymore. And, actually a brilliant moment from the Earl's Court gig was we came off and we were finished the gig, and it was like we were really building things up to a climax. We used to kind of finish the gigs with this really kind of freak out jam thing, and loads of feedback and, you know, go mental on the drums. And kind of the Who influenced Finish.
Minus the Dino. Minus blowing up the bass players.
No smoke bombs or anything like that, the bass drum. But we used to try and finish in this big explosive kind of way. And we were coming off stage and we were just wringing wet, just soaked with sweat and all that. And, you know, people were like, you know, patting us on the back. You're coming off stage, whoever's like the road crew and all that sort of stuff. And we were getting these towels and just putting our faces on the towels like that. And there was one fella who was really aggressively clapping us on the back and shaking hands. And he was going, "That was great. That was really fabulous. That was fantastic." And it was Jimmy Page.
What?
Holy fuck.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Had come to...
What?
Yeah, had come to see us. Well, not come to see us, but, well, he come to see the whole gig. But his daughter had taken some pictures of us. She's a really great photographer. Wow. Scarlett Page. And she had photographed us at a gig. And she was like, "I keep going on to me dad about these lads. I keep going on about wanting to get him to..."
Jimmy fucking Page.
Yeah.
And when you think of the history.
Yeah.
What Jimmy Page has done for music.
One of
those, when you think of a Gibson Les Paul.
One of the main men.
Jimmy Page. Jesus, man. That must have been some moment.
Yeah. So he was an absolute gent, yeah. And I think he'd seen us. We'd done Glastonbury that summer.
Yeah. What was that like?
That was good. Yeah. I don't really remember much about it, in the sense that I'm not really a festival fan. I'm not into the festival experience.
The grit.
I kind of feel like it's like whenever you're in that cycle of touring and all that, you know, festivals, they're good exposure for you, and you play to people who you're not necessarily going to reach otherwise.
Okay.
Which is kind of the main advantage I see to them. But if we could, like, I mean, I'm kind of just, if I could play in a nice old, you know, like student union hall or something like that, most of the time. That's where I like playing the most, you know, or like a club or something like that.
Yeah.
That's kind of the level I enjoy the most.
Yeah.
Then when you get into the festival thing, I don't know, just the buzz of it never really hits me.
It wasn't the same.
But having said that, you obviously want to be on the bill, because it means that you're getting out there to different audiences and all that. But I kind of had more of a professional attitude to the festivals, where, like, Glastonbury was actually fantastic the first year, because we were on the John Peel stage, which kind of is a nice bit of cred to it and all that sort of stuff. So I would have spent a lot of time listening to old John Peel sessions on YouTube. When I was in my early to mid-teens, you know, like, you're listening to...
You're playing on the stage.
Would have listened to, like, you know, The Damned or The Buzzcocks and all them bands, John Peel sessions on YouTube. You know, I would have been surfing through all them.
Yeah.
And... so it was fantastic. Jeez, it was amazing. And I think Jimmy Page had seen us. Yeah, I actually know he had seen us on the Red Button. He was watching Glastonbury on BBC.
Oh, yeah, and he
went for the Red Button, looking through, because just seeing what the bands were like, and him just sitting at home. And he got into us because, you see, we were so influenced by the Yardbirds.
Mm.
And he was in the Yardbirds for the last 2 years of their career.
Yeah, he had played, and Eric Clapton.
Eric Clapton,
and the wonderful Jim Gordon on drums had played.
And the period with there was a period in the Yardbirds where Jeff Beck and Jimmy Page were in the band. So that's, you know, when you talk about wanting to be transported to gigs. I think I'd be happy out of the Yardbirds gig where Jeff Beck was stage left, Jimmy Page was stage right.
Can you imagine? And, like, those people hadn't a clue what they were seeing at the time.
Yeah. Because supposedly they supported the Stones on the tour around that time. This is my obsessive knowledge coming in here. The Stones, Ike and Tina Turner, and the Yardbirds with Beck and Page in the lineup.
Man, and imagine that for a gig, if you could go back to see that gig.
And supposedly the Yardbirds were the unfollowable act that night. Apparently.
Who was that?
The Yardbirds, they were the act that blew everybody off, that kind of thing. Because you had Beck and Page dueling on either side of the stage, you know. Yeah. So we were Yardbirds crazy, and so the fact that Jimmy was there, that was mental.
Wow.
And so we got to have a wee chat with him and all that sort of stuff. It was great. And he really is a gentleman. Like, he's a really lovely fella. And his daughter then, she was kind of an advocate of ours, I'd say, in the early days, because she was, you know, and I think in that kind of classic way, everybody's the same. She'd been trying to get her dad to listen to us.
Yeah.
And he's kind of going, yeah, whatever. And then he sees us on the telly, and then he goes to her I was just watching this band, and it was the band that she'd been talking about the whole time.
Wow. Like, I've been telling you about this for
so long. Yeah. So there was a bit of that, I understand, going on. So
that's amazing.
That was a highlight. Big style, big highlight. And actually, we did spend time with Jeff Beck as well. He did come to see us.
No way.
Yeah, which was a massive...
That's incredible.
Because I was incredibly choked.
God rest Jeff Beck.
Yeah, I was seriously choked up about him dying because the Yardbirds, his era, the Yardbirds in particular, was a big foundational influence on my musical thing, but also because we did get to spend a bit of time with him and all that sort of stuff. Like, he came to see us in London.
The recording studio, wasn't it?
He turned up when we were making the first album and we jammed him for a little bit, which was mad. We did a Yardbirds rave up with him.
That's
you know, because
cool.
We did a couple of them,
man,
them tunes in the set. We covered a few of them, you know.
Those
so.
Experiences.
Yeah. So it was wild.
Priceless.
Yes, that was wild. And so that was that kind of brought me back when he died. So suddenly that brought me back to that time, and I was really emotional about it. I was like, fuck, that's really shit that he's not around now.
Just one of those immeasurable forces.
Absolutely. And the Jeff Beck group, the early albums he did with the Jeff Beck group, he had Ronnie Wood on bass, a young Rod on vocals, pre Die, I Think I'm Sexy, Rod. And when Rod was kind of had a bit more cred going on, and those early Jeff Beck group albums are just
he was a genius,
absolutely insane.
And then the third album, which you said, Spitting Image, Ethan Jones,
who's that's another Beatles Get Back connection, because Glyn Johns, who's producing the sessions, that's his dad.
No way.
So Ethan Johns is Glyn Johns' son. So Glyn Johns had done. He did them Beatles Get Back sessions, and he's
famous for one of the best drum miking techniques
of all time. When the levee breaks and all that stuff.
His setup for that Glenn Johns method.
The miking technique.
Two overheads and a kick and a snare. And absolutely incredible.
Real,
Bonham sound, man.
Minimalist. And it wasn't recording the. Didn't they record that? Didn't they record that in a big old house? They were in like a kind of.
I think it was something to do with. A corridor.
They had
been out of the control room or out of the recording room, and there was a conversation, or either a drum was being tuned. I don't think I'm 100% accurate on this, but
something was going on. I remember that they would tuck the drums out of the studio setup. And
someone had said, like, wow, this would feel incredible.
The resonance.
Talk where everyone thinks it's that. You know, one E, it's like it's just a single kick and the resonance carries on to the
absolutely.
Next note.
Absolutely.
Just that huge sound.
Absolutely.
It's definitely one of my favourite Bonham tracks among others.
It's just incredible.
We could probably sit here and talk about John Bonham all day.
Oh, we could surely. Jeez, like, I mean, he might. So Glyn Johns, he would have mic'd the drums for Ringo, Keith Moon, John Bonham. He would have recorded all them lads. You know, like, he produced them Who's Next. He produced even the early Who stuff, My Generation and all that. He would have been the engineer on all that. And some of the early Stones stuff he would have done.
No way.
He was big in that early kind of British blues boom era, with our British R&B thing, that it was like, you know, early Stones, early Who. It's a fairly inexhaustible list of incredible stuff that he was involved in.
It's funny how one man has brought out the best drum sounds, or some of my favourite drum sounds.
Of some of the best drummers.
Like, any of Bonham's stuff is just untouchable. Just Charlie Watts from the Stones.
The rock solid player.
God rest Charlie.
Yeah, another one that
Honky Tonk
choked us all up
just
bits.
One of my favourite drum tracks.
Just
the sound.
Charlie's kind of weird, wonky way of doing things. He just had his own kind of little feel. And that's the thing that, and it's like with Charlie Watts and Ringo and all that, I absolutely love those kind of players, because it's like, you mightn't be thinking, oh, well, it's a million fills a second and it's, you know, crazy. You know, it's not flash, or it's not like drum acrobatics. It's not like, but try and play it like they can play it, and
it's,
you can't
groove,
do it.
It's feel,
yeah.
And I would have explained this to Gavin before with feel and bits and pieces, and you would be very much aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, that you could get 100 drummers in a room to play Ringo's parts, to play Charlie's parts, to play Bonzo's parts.
Yeah.
None of them will sound the same.
It won't happen. And you can't get... You can try... Like, I used to try and get the Ringo feel, the windshield wiper.
Yeah.
On the hi-hat. Yeah. You know, style, try and play it like that. I've tried to do that loads of times, and all those little stop-starty fills and the bass drum. He had a really powerful bass drum. Mm. Like, he's a really loud drummer, Ringo.
Yeah.
Nobody really... outside of real drum nerds wouldn't be aware of, he's really beating the shit out of it, like, especially on the early live Beatles stuff, he's absolutely kicking the shit out of the kit and crashing on the ride, and he's really got this amazing,
he's enthusiastic when he's going.
And he has that shuffle as well, like when he does this, like a more country and western shuffle that he brings into some.
Steve Jordan, if you're familiar with Steve, I'm sure you are, of course. One of my favourite drummers has a great clip on YouTube where he talks about that Liverpool
shuffle,
sort of feel and swing, the kind of cavern,
the cavern stomp,
you know, like the hi hats being on the money and like the snare being sort of a little lazy, and you know, the bass drum just being that little bit forward, and he's like completely trying to get everything all in the one, is just like
all at the same time, and you just have that, as you say, same as Charlie Watts doing a kind of a blues shuffle or something like that. He just has his own kind of thing going on, you know, and like. I mean, I was a Keith Moon fanatic from day one as well, you know, trying to get some of that weird kind of like, with Keith Moon, it's like it's this constantly rolling. It's kind of like it's in its own time signature, even though what he's playing doesn't necessarily fit. You don't think, you're kind of going, where's the 1, 2, 3, 4 sometimes? It's kind of, you think he's lost, but he's not, because he has his own internal.
It's his own thing.
Yeah, he has his own internal time signature that he's always sticking to, even if what he's playing is just like, you know, I saw a thing the other day that was so spot on that it's like, you know, a Keith Moon groove, like what most people would, like a Keith Moon 4/4 beat is what most other drummers would consider the most outlandish fill in the song.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Yeah, He'd do the most outlandish fill on a constant rolling thing, you know, like, and it's
right in the moment, like, isn't
it?
That was his own unique twist on it.
Totally.
Can we go back then to, sorry, when you were touring America?
Yes. That's kind of back to
the first album
period. Yeah.
You had fun in a Toronto show.
Oh yeah. So I was telling this story recently as well that this was only the week before or within like a week or whatever, 8-9 days before we did the David Letterman show, which is kind of the apex of our American.
I actually watched that the other day.
Oh, really? The American jaunt was...
That must have been amazing, though, in fairness.
Oh, it was fantastic. Yeah, it was fantastic. And we were kind of riding a bit of a crest of the... It had all gone on and it had all kind of snowballed to this ridiculous kind of extent that we were getting, you know, the producers, David Letterman, wanted us on the show. So it was like... That came about because we played Side by Side West in Austin, Texas.
Okay.
So, you know.
I'm sure that was incredible in itself at the time.
Oh, absolutely.
Some huge names on that.
Mm. And I think a lot of bands kind of, it's like our tour that we did around that time was like, so we played in like Nashville and Memphis and it was fairly empty. The gigs were pretty empty.
Okay.
And, you know, because it was the first time in America, all that sort of stuff. And, you know.
Nashville's a fun city.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And like we went all day, the main drag, like all the country bars and seeing all the real country players and all that. We did do a bit of that. And what you call it? Yeah, so Nashville and Memphis, they're fairly empty. A couple of people turned up, as in like maybe like 20 or 30 people turned up in a room that could have held a couple of hundred.
Okay.
So like that was grand. You're thinking, well, this is the American thing. You just have to slog it out. And so we played... played in Side by Side West in Austin, Texas. Excuse me. Played in Austin, Texas for Side by Side West, and it was like, what you call it? Like you have to like be racing around the city playing as whatever gigs you get booked to play. It's all happening in those 3 days.
Okay.
And every gig you play there is like a showcase for TV producers, label heads. Right.
So you gotta be on your game.
So it's kind of like the ultimate industry. Summit, basically. They all go down to Austin, Texas, all the people, the pluggers, the radio people, the label people, the TV people, they all kind of check out. It's all these kind of, you know,
showcase
sort of things. And so we would have played, I think we did something like 9 gigs in 3 days.
Whoa.
Like, as in you have to like race around playing all these spots. So like, whatever, we had really good agents actually in America and they were like, they got us all these little slots, and you have to, it's all like 45 minute sets. Wow. So you're like in, out, like horsing the gear up and down the street, running all over the city, into the back of the van you've hired, going all over the place. So it was
go,
mental.
Go, people, and then you're trying
yeah,
to
and get navigating the city, yeah, and like the big American cities. Yeah. And you have to. Everything's bigger in Texas. Yeah. And you have to be on the, they've got their Southern hospitality. You have to be in good form for that.
Yeah.
And all that sort of stuff. So you have to be giving your best sort of thing, like everywhere you go. And obviously we were really at that stage thinking, well, this is it, we're in America, you have to give it, you know.
Everything.
Yeah. And it's like, who the fuck would have thought we'd have been doing this? So that was then, like, you know, once you got to the stage of, because like I say about, the buzz would have got to a certain extent naturally, and then it becomes a career. Once you sign, and once you're putting out albums, and once you're doing this and that, that's when the kind of thing of, okay, well, you have to kind of pull your socks up here and actually get some kind of a result, that as long as it's like, if you think you've got it in you and you think it's what you want to do and put yourself beside it, put, you know, 100% behind it, which at that stage we were really thinking, yeah, we're in America now, we have to go for this, you know.
Yeah.
And we did all them like 9 gigs in 3 days, whatever it was. We were dead in our feet. Like, you'd have no time you wouldn't really even be conscious of where you were and what you were doing, because as soon as you were done the fourth set of the day, so you just were gone.
You don't know where you're coming or going.
Yeah. And you're running over the city at the same time, and people, there's like, you're meeting 100 people, and it's all this kind of craziness. But, and like, the first gig is like at 10 o'clock in the morning, like the first set.
Wow.
It was at 10 in the morning, and it's like, we were all really like, and at that age as well, we were all peak teenage lion kind of era as well when we were on tour. So like, you're playing a full pelt set, loud. I think it was like an outdoor gig somewhere in the city, in a kind of a garden type, like a public park.
Okay.
They turned into like an outdoor stage, and we played really early doors. Did a set there, and I think that's what the Letterman people saw.
Okay.
Like, they were at that. And through our American label and agents and all of that, that had come on board, that's how Letterman came about.
Wow.
And so
from Austin, like,
yeah. So that was the kind of genesis of that. But so then Toronto, so that happened.
Yeah.
And then so that was at the start of the tour. So we did those two gigs.
You ruptured your.
Yeah, I don't even still know what happened exactly, but we'd done those two gigs. Then South by Southwest, and from South by Southwest, we won the Best New Band prize at South by Southwest. We were the band of the festival.
Daily.
So we were the Grulk prize, they call it, I think.
Okay.
So that was a huge honour, Evan.
Yeah. Massive. So we won the Best New Band prize. And that just spread the buzz, in the sense that by the time we worked our way along the tour, the gigs were getting fuller and fuller.
Yeah.
And then New York ended up being sold out, and the LA gig at the end was sold out.
Wow.
And so we were playing in clubs, but like, you're getting a couple of hundred people like coming to see you still. And so, like, the buzz was just kind of snowballing as we were on our way to the bigger gigs. So then we were playing in places like Atlanta, Georgia, and things like that. And it was like, oh, geez, actually really good turnout kind of thing. And
I think your style would have went down very well down in the South.
Well, we were very, very much American influenced in that way. Yeah. Like, it's kind of like we were influenced by the kind of Anglophile English version of American
blues, R&B,
rock and roll.
Because Atlanta would have been
soul music, and all that sort of stuff was all factoring into what we were listening to, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
Mm. Definitely had that dance factor. When you hear that music, you want to get up, you want to dance.
And the whole point of the gigs for us as well was influenced by bands like Dr. Feelgood and The Who and all that. You're going out and it's full throttle. It's like full punch in the face from the first song
from the get-go,
you know. It's kind of like, we used to try and go like, how many songs can we get away with going straight from one to another without having a heart attack, you know, that you're like, you know, it's nearly like you'd be finishing the song, the big finish, go boom, two, three, four, straight into the next song. So how long can you keep that going, keep it?
Well, like, you've done 9 shows in 3 days.
Exactly.
You've done
exactly
it.
Out there to see that the energy that this man would perform with is absolutely incredible shows in 3 days.
That's nuts, man.
We were, and again, it's funny that even being the little bit younger that I was then, that's going to be 10 years ago now. This time 10 years ago we were doing that.
That's crazy.
So even the younger, I was 16 then. So like, the added advantage of the youth thing, or maybe 17 I was then, the added advantage of being that bit younger, you do have that kind of
going, yeah,
energy reserves. Mm. You know what I mean? That even now I'd be a bit more like, how long am I playing for? You know, that kind of like,
yeah, what, three shows today?
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
And tomorrow. And tomorrow.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Not so sure about that. But yeah, so but we were just on that, as you say, the whirlwind of it.
Yeah.
And by the time we reached Toronto, we were about, as I say, about 8 or 9 days out of hitting New York and doing a couple of New York gigs and doing David Letterman. So that was a mad thing. And we did Conan O'Brien as well in LA too. So it was all...
Did you play on the Universal Studios?
We did. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So the weird thing was, it was Paramount Pictures.
Paramount.
So yeah, so the weird thing. So the Conan O'Brien show was on the Warner Brothers lot.
Yeah,
so I don't know. That's what I was on. You know, like Animaniacs?
Yeah.
With the Warner Brothers Tower?
Yeah.
So it was and like Looney Tunes and all that. So it was like that's the first thing my brain...
Pinch me moment.
Yeah, yeah. So my
You're
brain...
You're waiting for one of them to jump out of the tower and go back into it.
So like straight away, what that, and I think, I don't know whether that's my warped reference point, that I'm not thinking, people think there's glamour, people jump to the glamorous, oh, the celebrities, that this and that, and my straight up thing, I was like, the Looney Tunes Tower, that's like, you know,
this is Hollywood.
Yeah, you know, like when like,
in the brain.
Yeah, when like Daffy like Duck and Porky Pig are trying to get past in the studio security in those cartoons.
Yeah,
and all that. So like, that's what I was thinking of, was like all them cartoons and all them things you grew up with.
You come in the gate and we're like, today we're gonna
rule the world. Same thing we do every night. And so that was where my head was at, and we were like, fucking Warner Brothers Tower and this and that, and seeing all the sound stages and all the
so much going on there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And all the other TV shows are being made in the other studios and all that. And so that was for Conan. And then we also did a gig on the Paramount Pictures.
Yeah.
Lot.
I read that. Yeah.
Met a guy called Randy Spendlove.
Randy Spendlove.
It was the man who organised the gig. I can say that now and make fun of his name, because I'm never going to be there again. So
he must have got some
good time
at school, I think.
Yeah, I think he was like he was a lovely guy. He was a really nice fella, but he came in and he was like, he was making a joke of it. He was like, hey guys, Randy Spendlove, that means something different for you guys. You know? not in the American lingo.
He knew the crack.
Yeah.
So fast forward then, you have a new project now.
Yeah. Well, I'll just say what happened in Toronto.
We didn't get there.
We never got there. We went all around the house. That was my fault bringing us all around.
No, that's good. Let it go, man.
Nine days before Letterman show, basically on stage in Toronto, whacked the cymbal.
Yeah.
I'd been having pains in my hands anyway, coming off stage, like my tendons in my hands are really sore. And I was trying to keep an eye on it, but then crashed into the cymbal, and I thought, feels like there's like cold water running all over my hand. That's really weird.
Afraid to look.
Yeah, afraid to look. But I did look, and this finger was like hanging out of its socket,
like
kind of thing.
Compound fracture. Yeah, that kind of thing.
And it was like
poking through.
Yeah, purple and blue and every other colour except the colour it was meant to be. And so it was like hanging out in three times the size. And still kind of played for another little while just like that. Just like tapping, like as in, you know, doing like quarter notes on every, just you know, crashing the cymbal just to try and keep something happening. And like the tour manager and all, my dad was there, work roadieing for us, so they were running on trying to spray it with this stuff and all that. And basically, long story short, we cancelled all the stuff leading up to Letterman. And by the time we did Letterman, I was probably still only able to play one song through without... Mm.
Yeah,
without
pain and just blood and everything. Absolutely, probably.
Yeah. And so the morning of Letterman, my finger was still in a splint. Yeah, yeah. And then I ended up, it was cortisone injections that cured me in the end.
Yeah.
Which after New York, I think we went to the West Coast. We went to San Francisco and all that, and like the gigs kind of resumed because I was able to play again. But it was because I was injected with this cortisone stuff that they were saying all the baseball players, like, all because they have the bat, your tendons get fucked from playing baseball. So that was the cure in the end.
That was the magic sponge.
Yeah. Oh, there's a fella in San Francisco who has the cure there.
He's the cure of the tendonitis finger.
Yeah, and it turned out cortisone injections is the cure.
Wow, that's some crazy stuff. You weren't missing that opportunity of playing a Letterman.
No, so that was the whole thing. So
if the finger was hanging off,
so
you
I was like taking 25 steroids in a day to try and, you know, like all these medications I was put on to try and. The whole idea was, everyone was going Letterman. This is like this.
You got to do this.
Yeah. And it was like
you conquered that adversity, man.
Thankfully, yeah. Thankfully. Yeah. And if it had been, thankfully, even it was like, as I say, a week or 10 days before, not 2 days before. You know what I mean? If it had been just that slight bit different, you know, you would have been really up shit creek, I think, you know, trying to make it happen, you know. Probably would have ended up, you know, my whole arm would have gone in or something like that, you know.
Yeah, you compensate then with something else and end up having other niggles and other injuries. And
exactly. So I took to wearing, after that, for the next probably 9 months, you know, the heel patches that women get for wearing high heels.
Yeah.
I used to put them on my fingers.
All right.
And bandage my fingers up.
Tape them.
Yeah, for like the next couple of months.
Vintage Lars Ulrich.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. Yeah.
And so it was like high heel shoe fucking spongy things.
It worked.
That was what worked. So we used to run to the chemist before the gigs and get them and just like the base of your finger, just stick them on and bandage them up.
Yeah.
That's what saw me through in the end.
Before we move on, I just want to ask you one question about like obviously the hype was huge.
Yeah.
Coming back to Cavan then.
Yeah.
Seeing your friends.
Yeah.
What was it like? How did people, did they?
That was kind of my favourite bit nearly, was the coming home after being away. You know what I mean? Because it was nice that there was
you know, like the Irish thing. Oh, dude.
Yeah, well,
that
sure.
Prick.
Yeah.
That boy was over in America.
Yeah.
giving it to big one.
Yeah.
Thinking he's the big fella.
Yeah.
People were cool though.
People were very cool. Everyone we kind of, all our friends and family were very cool about it. Maybe there might have been people maybe more removed. There might have been a bit begrudging or something. That's all. Yeah. That's par for the course.
That's, really, of course.
In that kind of way that there's going to be somebody like
that. You get that early, that won't last.
Yeah, exactly.
But yourselves.
Yeah.
Yous were still settled. Yous had a good.
We totally settled in Cavan and everything. That was the whole
thing. But I mean, there was no ego. Yous were settled.
No. Yeah. Like, I mean, because we kind of had the Cavan thing. I think again there was a big influence there with like again the formative thing of watching music documentaries and getting into the world of bands that we loved. So bands like The Undertones we'd have been huge fans of. I remember seeing The Undertones thing really early, just as we started touring. I remember getting really into The Undertones and watching their documentary, and their whole thing was they never left Derry and they still live in Derry now. Like, we actually did get to play with them and stuff like that, but along the way I played festivals with them and stuff like that, and they were always based in Derry. They always had the same friends. Always lived in and around home. That was their whole kind of thing. And it was all that real ordinary Irish lads wearing, like, you know, Doc Martens and half-mast jeans and all that. And then Dr. Feelgood was like that as well. They were Canvey Island down in Essex was where they were from. And they were very, like, closed shop. We're from Canvey Island. That's our thing. This is our whole mythology they built up around the place. They called it Oil City to make it sound more bluesy.
Okay.
And they used to bring journalists down there and get them hammered and you know, take them around on the tour of Oil City, because it was like a real industrial island in the Thames Estuary with all these oil tankers and that. And they used to say, oh, it's like the Mississippi Delta and it's like this and that and the other, and they'd bring the party to them as opposed to going to where the other thing was. And so I always kind of hated that thing of, if you're in London or New York or whatever, we ended up chasing the party of where's it happening.
We gotta be where it's at.
I was always totally anti that. I was like, fucking, we'll bring it with us. You know, that kind of thing was the way we looked at it, and I probably was very much the culprit of that. I was the one pumping that attitude out at that time the most strongly out of everybody, probably. There was, you know, we were really kind of wary of everything all the time, and just wanted it.
It definitely sounds like you've had a good structure behind you from day one, like,
thankfully,
between yourselves as well. It seems like you've all had a good mindset of, let's not fuck this up.
Yeah. And I think genuinely just a more of a kind of a, I don't know whether what that is about the mindset we were in or whatever, but we'd be more wary of things than we would be like jumping in whole hog.
Because, you know, the smoke and mirrors, man, a lot of people go for it.
Yeah. Oh, totally.
You can be fooled by it.
Yeah. And I mean, some of us, as time went on, some of us might have partied more than others, like, you know, I mean, and that all goes on as well.
Yeah, of course.
But it was very much...
I think that's all part of the experience.
Yeah, really. But it was very much in the kind of normal way of, like...
Yeah, it's very hard not to.
Yeah. And, like, you know, if people want to... Some people want to stay up and have a drink and do whatever, and some people are fucked and from the gig and thinking, well, we have to be on the road whatever time in the morning. It becomes that kind of... routine, really. It becomes like, you know, because it's something you do. We did it like solid for like 8 years or something like that. We just kept, we're gigging and gigging and gigging. It just becomes, you start thinking more about, well, where am I going to get food? Where are we going to eat? How far away is the hotel from the venue? How much time do I have when I get to the hotel? How much time do I have to shave and shower and, you know, get me stage clothes ready? You know, you're doing all that stuff. Yeah. That's your day, you know.
Yeah.
It becomes more of a kind of a, you get to the hotel that you're staying in, you plonk on the bed, you know, you watch telly for a bit maybe, or just fuck around, maybe doze off on the bed for a while.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, fuck, we have to go in for sound check, and you have to go and do it. And you, it's just like...
It was quite structured, like,
that's
in
just,
a way.
It just becomes like life. It just becomes like, you know...
And then the door knocks you up.
Yeah. So it just becomes that, like...
Fuck with
you. And it's like, yeah, fucking your man's not answering the phone. And, you know, as in, like, someone, whoever's staying in the other room, somebody's... You know, got the time wrong. We were the van's picking us up in 5 minutes, and one of the lads is only just getting in the shower, and it's all that kind of.
Because you recorded some of that stuff, didn't you?
We did. So Pete, the bass player, you have to give him all the credit for that.
I think it was actually Toronto. There was footage of he's in the hotel and stuff. Yeah. Getting up, just what you just said.
Oh yeah, exactly. So yeah, you have to give Pete total credit for that, because. He got very into cameras and editing videos and things like that as things went on. So the last, maybe, well, the last American tour was fully documented it, and he called it The Surprisingly Dull Adventures of the Stripes.
Yeah.
Which is, that's pretty much what, and like Q YouTube comments, nothing surprising about these lads being dull, what? You know, kind of thing.
But there's always a few in there.
Yeah, but... it was all part of the crack, and so I actually they're very very fond memories of them videos and things, because to be honest, you look at them, that's pretty much, if you want to know what it was like, that's pretty much it. And any kind of entertainment by that stage, because we were just a working band, so we'd had the buzz of celebrities name dropping you and this and that, but by the time we did them videos, that had kind of passed, that time had passed, as in like the celebrities had given us the endorsement. They're not going to give you the endorsement all day, every day for 8 years.
Yeah.
You know, so it just kind of settles into a groove then.
Mm.
And I kind of enjoyed it more after the hype. The hype kind of lasted maybe 18 months, 2 years. If I was to be really candid, I think the second album kind of killed the hype a wee bit, but because I don't think it was that good.
Okay.
But that was due to a record label interference and things like that. But we just had settled into the groove of, we're a working band.
Mm.
We have a year full of tours, and we have our audience, and we're releasing music, and we're you're doing that's the thing that that's the thing that I wanted to do. I didn't want to be let's say we had like celebrity endorsements from people like let's say, like, here's a really weird example. So the first time we played in LA, we played in the Troubadour, which is
big
spot.
Yeah,
and Elton John was mad into us at this stage. And yeah, he owned the
rock. He was quoted, wasn't he? Saying, like, he was the next best thing.
We were the last. Yeah. And that kind of thing, it's funny, because even when those things happened, there was part of me that was going, you're saying we're going to be this, we're going to do that. And I was saying, but... we're not, though. We're just not. Because we're like these random lads from Cavan that just have managed to fluke this thing of being particularly gelling together.
I don't think it was a fluke, man.
Oh, yeah, but you know what I mean? That it just kind of happened.
Yeah, okay.
And we were...
Yeah, you feel when, as you said earlier in the interview, if there was no plan or that wasn't plan. Really the direction, you were playing music.
Yeah.
There was no aspiration in the beginning to say, I want to be a famous rock star.
No, the aspiration was like, I'd love to do that. I'd love to cover that song. I'd love to do a really good set, get a really good set together and... You know, it was more like, what are we going to wear on stage? And
yeah.
Are we going to put together a real cool gig? And, oh, look at that. I want to fucking, you know, Dr. Phil did that. I want to copy that. I want to do this. I want to do that. And all the kind of, just pure teenage kind of doing it for the love of it, you know, obsessed.
Yeah.
And because our, I'm throwing the word nerdy around again, I think we were very, very nerdy and very anal music fans. It wasn't like, you know, if I do this, you know, all the girls going to fancy me and all this stuff. It was it wasn't the thinking behind it. It was like, or being a poser or anything like that. It was really kind of like, you know, push, you know, like, you know, getting our, you know, pushing ourselves to get to the, you know, get like, you know, get kind of like an energy or get a kind of a, you know, a dynamic that we kind of thought was like the bands we were into, you know, that kind of thing.
The girls don't give a fuck about. The Ringo played a Ludwig kid. I got to play a Ludwig kid.
It was much more like it was
what size hi hats did he use? What crash cymbal did he use? It's like, you've lost her.
No, we were much more on the kind of, you know, and if I mean, like, if you can sort that side of it out along the way later on, that's great. But if we were much in the early days, we were much more like, you know, as you say, well, it was during the sessions for Beatles for Sale that George Harrison switched from his Gretsch Tennessee and back to his Gretsch 365 Country Gentleman. You know, it's like totally that kind of level of nerdy, techie, all about all that sort of stuff. And just because we were coming from that very, it was like a very internalized, obsessive place, we weren't projecting out of, I want to be playing here this time next year. I want to be this time next year we'll be millionaires. It was never that
this time next year we'll be millionaires.
That's what I was thinking. There was never that kind of, there was no Del Boys in the band really,
but you're still at that everyone's a winner moment.
Fabulous. What can't speak can't lie. But what was I going to say? I suppose that's the kind of unusual thing about it, that we were more kind of lost where we were coming from with the question originally
which is Elton John.
People endorsing us. So saying we were going to be the next big thing and the next big this and that, because we never in our heads thought we're going to be the next fucking big thing. We honestly never thought that, which means we probably didn't have it in us to be the next big thing, as in we got a level of success that we were fucking chuffed to bits with, and we were like, this is amazing. We have an audience, we're touring. You know, we've done some amazing things. We've been on telly, we've been on the radio, we've done all the checklist things.
Yeah, you've done it all.
You know, like, and it was nearly just like, ticking that off. Who'd have thought we'd have done any of those things? That's amazing.
You've done it all very fast.
Yeah, all very fast. So I think because there wasn't that drive of like, you know, we're going to be getting the sound of the summer, the next big hit thing is going to be us, man, that was never there. It was never in me, and it was never like a motivator, a driving thing. It was a pressure, it was an external pressure from later on, you know.
I'm sure you had that label, you know, there's going to be your name in lights, Madison Square Garden.
There was all that kind of bullshit said in the early days, and we were a bit like, us doing Bo Diddley covers is going to be the thing. Like, you know what I mean? It was really like, who the fuck, you know,
who's going to care about this?
Who that's not high is going to care about that? You know, as in like, or is going to think this is the next big thing? Like, it's you know, the next morning thinking, what was I thinking saying the fucking 16-year-old Bo Diddley thing was going to be like the next big fad? You know that? You know, like, can you hear yourself back? Like,
hindsight's a great thing though, all the same.
But like, I suppose we kind of, that's what we kind of were railing against, I suppose, was the kind of next big thing hype. In a way, we were loving having the experiences, and we were loving doing the bits that we thought were us expressing ourselves and all that. But so, so the Elton John thing. So Elton was a big endorsee or endorser of us. He endorsed us. And we played the Troubadour, and Elton came to see us at that. And he brought Muse with him and Lana Del Rey with him. So we met all them in the dressing room backstage and all that. And so this is the example I was going to give, that it's like, because it was never in my life plan to be in a dressing room with Elton John and Muse and Lana Del Rey, that was never in my kind of area of what I thought life was going to be like. I didn't strive for it. So when it was over, I didn't care, if you know what I mean. I didn't miss it. You know what I mean? So it was kind of like, oh, that's mad. In the way that, let's say,
that was fabulous that it happened.
It for part one of the conversation with Evan Walsh. Stay tuned till we start part two. See you then.